Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story. An epic, true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 4, Courage and Fate, The Battle for Acre. Saladin, who'd taken Jerusalem back after it had been in Christian hands for a century, made what seemed like just a small mistake in his great victory's aftermath. He didn't take Tyre, that little Mediterranean port as old as the world, that rested on a tiny rocky island shouldering the Syrian coast about 100 miles south of Tripoli. It was newly defended by Conrad, Marquis of Montferrat, brother-in-law to Queen Sibylla of Jerusalem, whose relationship with the throne of Jerusalem gave him considerable status in the Outremer. A swaggering adventurer and very possibly a criminal, he'd arrived in Tyre after departing Constantinople, where he was linked to a suspicious political murder. Conrad had taken robust control of what had been panicked disaster across the Christian East in the wake of the Hattin disaster, where Saladin defeated the Christian army and took the True Cross. Now Tyre would need every fiber of Conrad's prodigious energy and courage, because Saladin at last realized his mistake in leaving Tyre behind, and turned his warrior's face toward those ancient walls. Tyre was certainly no stranger to the prospect of being attacked. Its history essentially reads, "And then King so-and-so laid siege to Tyre, but after a long time and a great deal of useless effort, gave up." One siege, conducted by the biblical king Nebuchadnezzar, lasted 13 years. He still couldn't manage a decisive win. Alexander the Great, capable of conquering the entire world, couldn't take it. A key reason for Tyre's remarkable security was its island location, where the sea protected it on three sides, while the fourth was connected to the mainland by a cunning land built over three millennia by throwing rock, ship's ballast, cedars of Lebanon, and whatever else lay at hand into the narrow inlet that separated the island city from the continent. The land bridge was short, about a third of a mile in length, and had deliberately been kept narrow to deflect a full-on assault. It was further guarded by walls that reportedly were some 20 feet thick, rising 15 stories into the sky. A Muslim visitor wrote to a friend, "Anyone who seeks to conquer Tyre will meet with neither surrender nor humility." Another Tyrian strength was its splendid navy, befitting a city proudly calling itself the Queen of the Sea, anchored in a walled harbor that could be sealed off with immense iron chains. By the time Saladin belatedly turned toward it, Tyre had been even more thoroughly fortified under Conrad of Montferrat's direction. The relieved citizens might well boast that it had become unconquerable. Saladin certainly gave it his best try. 17 massive catapults were dragged to Tyre's landward wall, hurling stones the size of mules into the city day and night for 6 weeks. Just keeping the catapult crews supplied with acceptable rock must have been a serious undertaking. Saladin's fleet, the best the Muslims had ever had, floated up from the coast of Egypt to block Tyre's access to the sea. Regrettably for Saladin, things did not go well with either effort. The French broke the sea blockade with a dawn attack on sleeping Arab sailors, taking 11 of Saladin's valuable ships, an outcome that left the normally calm Sultan so furious he cut the ears and tail from his pitiable horse, which he then rode through the ranks of his army as a symbol of their dishonor. Regrouping, he threw his men into the causeway, clawing for a hold on Tyre's walls. They got nowhere. Shortly after New Year's Day 1188, Saladin did what most of his predecessors had done, which is to say, give up and march away over the sands of Syria. It was one of his few failures, but it was a bad one. As is often the case with men who have been too successful for too long, everyone who had thought him infallible began to worry that he wasn't, and he had indeed left a powerful lever for the Europeans on the Syrian coast. On the other side of the Mediterranean, those Europeans were at last building strength. The Saracens knew of it. Thomas Asbridge, a modern historian of the Crusades, cites a letter written by one of Saladin's inner circle in 1189, which demonstrated what Asbridge described as an incredibly detailed and accurate understanding of the Crusade's scope, organization, and objectives. It was understood that before the Christian hordes arrived, something decisive had to be done by great Saladin, but the setback at Tyre turned him. Like all conquerors, he had to conquer forever. Failure meant allies wandering off with their men and their money, rivals as alert as wolves. He had never been an epic risk-taker. Now, he was unwilling to play out even easy odds, worried about the political troubles that would follow a second reversal. Both Saladin and his opponents wrestled down into a stalemate that lasted throughout 1188 and on into the summer of 1189. The Saracens took a town here or a fort there, including two more small ports. For their part, the Christians of the Outremer, even Conrad of Montferrat, refused to come out from behind their walls. Little of note happened until August, that furnace of a month that exhausts and discourages, in the year 1189, more than 18 months since Tyre had mocked the backs of Saladin's departing troops. The driving force was the most humiliated leader in Christendom, Guy of Jerusalem, loser at Hattin, loser of Jerusalem, the historic center of Christendom, loser of one of the Western world's most precious relics and a Saladin hostage to boot. He was about to get out of prison. After taking Jerusalem, Saladin was considered a chivalrous prince. He held Guy in prison for a year, then let him go, depending upon the oath of a Christian, not to mention a Lusignan, that never again would his hand be lifted in war against the Saracens. One typically doesn't free a menace, so we can only assume that Saladin believed Guy sufficiently cowed that his return to society was of little concern. The humiliated loser would probably just melt away under the dazzling aura of the hero of Tyre, Conrad of Montferrat. Indeed, if Saladin had watched Guy's efforts to start life over in Tyre, efforts soundly rebuffed by Conrad, he would have felt even more confident that the dispossessed Guy was as dangerous as a milk calf. This time, Saladin turned out to be wrong. The refugee king of Jerusalem wanted his kingdom back. Within a year of being set free, Guy got himself absolved of his oath to never wage war against the Muslims, cobbled together an army of Templars, Hospitallers, and mercenaries, and set off on a campaign of such bravado that we still admire the man's audacity 8 centuries later. He intended to attack the great city of Acre, win it, and then use it to launch nothing less than the reconquest of Jerusalem. It was a magnificent goal. It was also seemingly little short of delusional. Acre was one of the biggest, busiest, richest, and arguably most sinful cities in the entire world in the 12th century. It was no stranger to Europeans. It had been a Christian holding 50 years before, at the time of the Second Crusade. Generations of pilgrims had poured through its streets on their way to Jerusalem. The Germans had stopped there before marching to Dorylaeum. It was Saladin who captured it this historical round, depriving the West of one of the best-situated ports on the Mediterranean, not to mention some of the Outremer's premier brothels. Like Tyre to its north, Acre was a marvel of fortification, built up over decades. It lay on a peninsula that sprouted from the Syrian coast, down into the Mediterranean, like a little thumb pointing south. The city was shaped like a jagged triangle, with its widest dimension running from northwest to southeast. To its south and west, the city was cradled by the sea. Its great harbor was at the southeast tip of the city, chipped from the end of the thumb. More than 75 ships from all over the world could anchor in that floating metropolis peopled by sailors, traders, travelers, stevedores, sailmakers, tar sellers, seagulls, and wharf rats. Everything that the citizens of Acre could fortify, including the entrance to their harbor, had been magnificently engineered, often with double walls 100 feet tall. Two of its defensive towers, built at corners where walls met, were so grand they had names of their own. The Cursed Tower to the northeast, where legend said the silver paid to Judas had been minted, and the 4-story Tower of Flies to the south, on the most exposed section of the harbor wall. Its odd name came from long-lost, half-remembered times when animal sacrifices on the site had drawn clouds of flies. The city's defenses were not only monumental in scale, they positively bristled with jeering Muslim archers, while King Guy had nothing but his ragtag collection of some 10,000 volunteers and mercenaries. He didn't even have siege machines. Just reaching the city was suicidal, since it required negotiating the mountains north of present-day Beirut, maneuvering through passes so tight that one of his knights wrote to his family that all the gold in Russia couldn't have kept them from destruction if the Saracens had attacked. And Guy knew that Saladin himself, army in tow, was on the way. To the happy defenders inside Acre, the former prisoner of war was nothing but a petty annoyance. He cautiously positioned his small army around a sawed-off hill slightly to the east of Acre, called Mount Toron, and waited for the few surprises he could bring to bear, namely a small fleet from Pisa carrying crusaders, along with some French knights and a few Germans, who landed on the beach to Acre's north and made themselves a camp. The Europeans, in turn, were quickly outnumbered by Saladin's arrival, his army settling in its thousands about 6 miles further off to the east. Saladin so outnumbered the Franks on their little hillside and in their little beach camp that he could have overrun them within days. Instead, for whatever haunted reasons, he sat within his lines waiting for more reinforcements. Historian Jeffrey Reagan thinks he was obsessed with the belief that German crusaders were just over the horizon with tens of thousands of fresh troops, a belief gleaned from a saber-rattling letter sent by their tough old bird of a leader, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa. As Saladin hesitated, worried about the imaginary flood of Germans supposedly about to smash their way across his lands, real ships from Europe began to drop anchor at Acre's shoreline, bringing crusaders, bringing equipment, bringing horses, bringing supplies. the Muslims inside and outside Acre's massive walls began to feel pricklings of concern. In early September, the biggest surprise of all arrived. Conrad of Montferrat, marching from Tyre with 20,000 infantrymen and 1,000 knights to support King Guy, a man for whom he had neither affection nor respect. This era preferred to avoid pitched battles. Skirmishes were a constant, as were sieges, but frontal assaults were rare. These two great armies did not immediately go at each other. Instead, there were probing attacks at various points along their arcing perimeters on the broad, sun-baked plain outside the city. The Saracens managed to break the western lines once, early on, hustling supply caravans into the city. Saladin took the time to visit Acre himself, still assured that he held the upper hand. On the flatland in front of Acre's splendid walls, he would see the Crusaders in their thousands, entirely outnumbered by Saracens who had formed a vast perimeter beyond the western lines, their almost uncountable colorful tents lit by desert sunfire. Finally satisfied that he had the superior force, he gave the order for his men to move across the entire front, intent on breaking the Christians into nothing but fragments. It didn't work. One Muslim wrote later that the Crusaders stood like a wall behind their shields, their lances and crossbows leveled. The Crusaders had little but a foothold. They should have been crushed, but they stuck. And in the meantime, more ships from the west floated with creaking oars and masts onto the shore north of Acre, offloading more men, more horses, more equipment, more supplies. On the fourth day of October 1189, a Wednesday, the great land battle of the Third Crusade began. What an epic sight it would have been to stand on a protected spot on the top of Acre's walls or at the summit of Little Mount Toron and watch as it formed. There were some 7,000 Crusaders in the attack, armored knights behind the crossbowmen and foot soldiers, war horses pulling at their reins. They all began to march away from Acre's walls, east toward the Saracen army, with Acre and the sea at their backs. Eyewitnesses said that their banners rode the sky high above on gigantic masts topped by crosses, carried on mule carts that jolted and bucked across the uneven ground. Facing them were more thousands of Saracen warriors, their beautiful swords, capable of splitting a man in two, glittering in the bright desert light. That walk must have seemed to last an eternity in time, every man on both sides working to steady his nerves for the inevitable. The first to fight were men at the north of the city, European archers and crossbowmen taking on Saracen swordsmen, close combat on a tremendous scale. The battle initially swung toward the Christians, who were so successful after cracking the Saracen front that they reached Saladin's personal camp, killing one of his servants. Saladin threw himself into the thick of it, rallying men who otherwise would have fled. His ability to steady them despite their losses turned out to be crucial, since success brought trouble to the Crusaders. The Westerners became distracted by the fantastic opportunity to loot. That simple human tendency toward greed left a gaping opportunity for the Muslims to counterattack. They took it. While fellow Crusaders were off grabbing golden cups and fistfuls of coins, a company of disciplined Knights Templar kept fighting. They found themselves alone, surrounded by Muslims. The Saracens were merciless. All the Templars in the contingent died. Then, one of the European looters lost control of his horse, which bolted back toward Acre. Crusaders turned to chase after the panicked animal. That's all it took to create a general rout, as other men in the western line saw fellow soldiers running, feared the worst, and ran themselves. Entire Crusader contingents were annihilated by Saladin's pursuing troops. There were legendary stories of heroism, men giving their lives to save others, as well as stories of rank cowardice. It was said that King Guy rescued Conrad, his greatest rival for supremacy in the Outremer, while a French nobleman wouldn't stop to help his own brother, who had been knocked off his horse and was surrounded by Turks. It could have been one of the greatest victories of Saladin's life. Yet once again, he wasn't quite able to finish what he had so promisingly begun. His men and horses were worn out by all the killing, which went on for hours. Some went off in a fury to chase down fellow Muslims who had decided to join the looting at Saladin's camp. Others decided enough was enough for one day and melted into the desert haze. Crusaders who had been out of the battle altogether, or who managed to rejoin their lines, made a stand and fought with the intensity of desperation. By the time night fell, the western lines had stabilized, but they had been terribly battered. One knight, known to us only as Ferrand, savagely hurt, crawled back so disfigured by his wounds that his people could barely recognize him. He surely would have died soon after. The Muslims flung hundreds of Christian corpses into a sluggish little river that ran along the edge of the Acre Plain, drifting them into the Crusader camp, where mass burial had to be added to the survivors' exhausted, blood-soaked stress. A tougher man than Saladin would have forced himself back into the battle. Such a man probably could have broken the Crusaders. Saladin didn't do it. A military psychiatrist of our own time has described battle fatigue as a combination of exhaustion, despair, and frustration. It finally brought this battle to a standstill, neither winner nor loser capable of lifting a sword even one more time. After 9 days of uneasy quiet, the Muslims simply gave up and pulled away. Historians still can't believe that King Guy's army, in enemy territory, outnumbered and virtually beaten in open warfare, snatched something like victory from such self-evident defeat. Saladin had his reasons for going. He too had lost men and horses, and he faced outrage over the looting by his own troops that had stripped wealth from the leaders of many important allies. Not a young man, he had also come down with some sickness that left him weak enough to sink into gloomy pessimism. Always a general who tended toward caution in battle, preferring to fight only when certain his superior numbers could carry the day, Saladin now edged away. Looked at with the calm certainty of hindsight, he should have steeled himself to go back in, since one more determined assault would pretty certainly have pushed the Christians into the sea. When he didn't, the psychological advantage swung to the Crusaders. It's better to be an underdog able to pride itself on holding its own rather than the clear winner who hasn't clearly won. The Saracens retreated while the Christians, stunned by their luck, had a chance to rest, resupply, and congratulate themselves on the marvel of their survival. King Guy, one of the crazy Lusignans from the Aquitaine, suddenly wasn't Christendom's greatest living failure. By now, it was mid-October. Left to themselves by Saladin's army, the Westerners dug in outside Acre. They built networks of defensive trenches, beastly work in that terrain. They built firing ramparts. They built the medieval equivalent of minefields outside their lines where trapdoor pits were jammed with needle-nosed wooden stakes. They dug wells and secured tents against the coming winter. As they sweated in the heat and dust, ship after ship crested the western horizon, carrying reinforcements and fresh supplies, including at least one boatload of limber young European prostitutes, eagerly reported to be capable of amiably kicking their heels above their heads. Even a few Muslims got wind of that fascinating news. Saladin, focused on the Crusaders rather than the girls, wrote a self-pitying letter to the Caliph of Baghdad to the effect that 1,000 new francs appeared for every one he managed to kill. knowing that spring would bring a renewed season for war, along with even more men from the other side of the Mediterranean. The Sultan spent the winter sending every archer, lance, bag of grain, and barrel of fresh water he could find into Acre. In the spring of the new year, 1190, bearded, lice-ridden Europeans who had spent the winter freezing on short rations outside Acre's walls raised their heads to the warmth of the young sun. They began to watch the sea. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again November 4th for the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.